Welcome back to another sparkling edition of the Two Mics on the Record.
Indeed.
I'm Mike Graham. Who are you?
My name is Mike Porky Parry.
And you have got the Porky Parry Review of Books, I
That's
believe.
Right, the Review of Books. Yeah, I've been reading books assiduously for the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, you told us just the other day
that
you've got more than 1,000 books.
1,000 books, yeah.
I mean, that's if you keep going at this rate, before you peg out, as some people have rather unkindly put it, you'll have a couple of thousand, won't you?
Well, maybe, but I've got to find somewhere to store them all. That's the problem with books, you know what I mean?
You should give them away.
Yeah, maybe. You know. Maybe I'll go and flog them to a second-hand bookshop because I get a good price
or
for
like
them.
Or car boot sales.
Car boot sales. Don't like car boot sales. Full of criminals.
You think so?
Criminality.
I thought car boot sales were part of the sort of the framework of England.
Well, they may be, but I mean, I never liked them. Never in America when
I've never liked them.
They call it a garage sale
or the yard sale or something. Yeah,
the garage sale. And Ross Mark, who was our Washington correspondent, who got so old he went like Doolally. no, he did. He did.
He told the grandfather clock.
Yeah, that's right. The grandfather clock. And he kept forgetting who the president was towards the end. By the way, you know, we'd be in the
If it was Reagan, he'd forgotten as well. By the way, so don't worry about it.
We were in the Washington Press Club, you know, and he saw an Australian accent, you know. You're going to be a good lad, you know. I'm going to put a word in with you for. And he turned to his girlfriend and said, who is it? You know, because he couldn't remember.
He did have that kind of halting way of speaking. He was just mistaking his halting way of speaking for, you know, forgetfulness.
He was always looking for, you know, a lady to talk to in the Washington Press Club all the time because his girlfriend was a very substantial woman, that's all I can say.
Substantial.
She's substantial.
What, big?
Yes, she was, yes. But she's a lovely girl.
Anyway, that's enough of slagging off the deck.
Anyway, listen.
What have you got for us?
Well, we've got a book here called How Was It For You?
Yeah.
And the subtitle is Women, Sex, Love and Power in the 1960s.
Right.
And it goes back and explores the idea that, you know, the 60s liberated everybody.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it went from black and white to colour.
Yeah.
You know, when the Beatles emerged and, you know, free love and all that and LSD. And the famous phrase is, like, if you can remember the 60s, you weren't really there and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But in fact, this book explores the idea that actually women were enslaved by the 60s, not freed by the 60s.
Okay.
Because, for instance, take...
is this written by a woman, by the way?
This book is written by Virginia Nicholson, who's a woman, right?
Well, it's a woman's name, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So, for instance, right, take the idea of rock stars and groupies.
Yeah.
That started in the 60s.
Yeah.
Started in the 60s,
I suppose en masse it did.
Yes,
but
it
I dare
did,
say
yeah.
that people like Frank Sinatra, who started in the 50s, would have had a few groupies.
Well, yeah, but he'd have had people brought to his room after the show because he'd be staying in the Waldorf Astoria or something like that.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is, what the rock stars of, like the Beatles, and I'm not blaming the Beatles independently, but rock stars in those days would have girls, like hundreds of girls, at the stage door.
Right.
And as they came out, the minders would pick half a dozen of them, put them in the car, and they'll go off back to the hotel. And then there'd be mass Rogerisation going on, and the girls would probably leave within 2 or 3 hours.
Are you not surprised that none of this has come out, you know, like in this kind of, you know, historic Me Too type movement thing that we're going through at the moment? I'm amazed that, you know, having gone through several sort of DJs from the radio, several actors and stuff, that they haven't really gone after any of the rock stars.
Right, okay. Well,
do you not think?
Well, yes and no, but I mean, it went on. And
I'm sure
it knows it went
on,
and there were so many hundreds of groupies. I mean, Bill Wyman said to have slept with over 1,000 women, okay?
Well, he got herpes, didn't he?
Did he?
I think so.
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, that's not good, is it? But, you know, what I was going to say was, is that I don't... How could you... You couldn't blame rock stars in those days, because the rock stars didn't say, right, unless you sleep with me, you're not coming to my concert, in the same way that movie directors are accused of saying... You won't get into my film unless you have sex with me.
Yeah.
There was no threat, would
you? No, they just wanted to.
Yeah, exactly. Now, it also says that the whole world changed when George Harrison married Patty Boyd, who was 21.
Right.
She was living a charmed life. In the 1960s, nobody did anything for money. The main goal was spirituality and creativity. And not caring about money channeled our creativity. If I needed some money... This is Patty Boyd talking, right? Then George or somebody in the office would just give it to me. Why was this? I think it's because there were more jobs available for women in those days. And if you needed money, it was, oh, I'll just work in this shop because I know the owners and they sell really cool clothes. Mm. But in fact, you're enslaved into the fact that as a woman, you were dependent on men for money.
Well, I mean,
men either had the businesses you went to work for or they were your husband.
Well, yeah, but that's her story. That's not everybody's story, yeah. is it? I mean, yeah. the point is that many women before the 60s
yes.
weren't really able to have a job.
No.
You know, they were told to have to stay at home,
yeah.
you have to raise the children, you don't yeah. really have to go out for to work for a living.
Yes.
And that's proper enslavement. This is not really enslavement.
Yes.
This is what you might call
yeah.
Enabling
yeah.
women to become successful. Surely.
Well, there's a woman here, and she was, her name is Jane Arden,
yeah.
and she was a playwright,
uh-huh.
right? And she says in this book, she says, women were finding their voice, but they still got a bad deal. Woman is singled out from the beginning. She's something special. Passive, frivolous, weak, lacking in leadership, incapable of dealing with power. Women are seen to be a slave group, appendages of men without identities of their own, and I'm talking about without them having their own freedom.
When did you start reading this feminist claptrap?
He says, no, sorry?
When did you start reading this feminist
Well, because
claptrap?
I am a feminist. I support women's rights. No,
I've heard
I do.
It all now.
I do.
I've heard it all now.
I do.
Never trust a man with a beard who claims to be a feminist.
No.
You can't be a feminist.
Nowhere was the woman more appendage-like than in the phallocentric, that's what it's called,
phallocentric
world of rock and roll.
What does that mean?
Well, we've just discussed that groupies were available at all times, 24 hours a day.
For phallus.
Yes, that's right. Phallocentric.
That's a ridiculous
phrase. No, it's phallocentric is a good phrase, right?
It's all true.
There were the Beatle wives, such as Cynthia Lennon or Patti Boyd, who've already talked about.
Yeah.
Tiptoeing around their Weybridge mansions.
Well, I don't think Yoko was particularly a shrinking violet,
well,
was she?
Yeah, but she wasn't his first wife. Cynthia was his first
no,
wife.
No, I know, but what I'm saying is that are you saying that it then changed then in the late 60s into something else?
Oh, yeah, definitely. This is at the start. This is like 63. Tiptoeing around their Weybridge mansions so as not to wake their superstar husbands who would be sleeping it off after a night of mass debauchery. Mm. Or the groupies, such as one called Katie, who was the autobiographical heroine of Jenny Fabian's book, Groupie.
Oh, yeah.
And this is rather disgraceful and distasteful. Who was once asked to give a rock star satisfaction by hand because he was good enough to admit he had caught venereal disease the previous night.
Right.
Right. That's quite, I mean, that's quite thoughtful, really, isn't it?
Thoughtful.
Well, don't you think so? I mean,
well, I wouldn't say thoughtful. Well, that's probably the word that would come to mind.
Well, I mean,
why didn't he go and get it treated?
Well, I think he probably had, but you can't treat it in one day, I assume that you have a course of tablets or something,
right.
or an injection or something
yeah,
like that,
yeah.
you know?
Penicillin, usually.
Penicillin, that's right, uh-huh. yeah. But after the sexual act had taken place,
yeah.
all the rock star said to this girl, Katie, then, was,
yeah.
please, would you press my trousers? I've got to go out.
Really?
So, you know, that wasn't really terribly romantic.
Well, I don't think she was probably thinking
yeah.
romance when she was doing what she was doing in that sort of particular
you know,
instance. I don't think you're thinking to yourself,
yeah.
oh, my goodness me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, that
yeah.
was the most romantic
yeah.
encounter I've ever had.
You know Brian Jones, obviously, the legendary...
Brian Jones, who died in the swimming pool.
He drowned in the swimming pool.
Yeah.
To this day, nobody knows how he drowned. And
was that in a house in Weybridge as well?
No. That was... Do you know whose house that was? That was A.A. Milne's house.
That's right. It was in Ashdown Forest.
That's right. Yes, that's right.
Down
yeah.
in Sussex. Down in just on the Kent Sussex border.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
In fact, I've been past it.
I should
have remembered that.
And there's a stream and there's a bridge over the
yeah.
stream and that's where they made poo sticks.
Yeah, I've been there as
but,
well.
You know, which starred in A.A. Milne's book Winnie
I've
the Pooh.
I've been there too.
And they threw sticks in the river and saw how they raced down the river. But nobody knows whether he drowned. Whether he was killed by a local builder who said he hadn't paid him for work done his house. Yeah.
No.
There's a conspiracy theory
Rubbish.
That Brian Jones was murdered, that his head was held down in the water by the builder because
really?
He'd gone
well, what
round...
were the others doing?
Well, what happened was Mick Jagger and Keith Richard drove down in a hallucinogenic state, it is alleged,
yes.
although nobody quite knows what was going on in those
no.
days. But they drove down to the house... Because they were going to tell Brian Jones he was out of the group.
Right.
Despite the fact that Brian Jones
was the kind of creative genius.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And had formed the Stones. But Brian Jones was then so in the grip of drugs, right, that he couldn't function. He didn't turn up for, recording sessions. He didn't turn up for, you know, practicing or run-throughs or anything like that.
Well, this is what it always brings it back to. Yeah. Where Keith Richards, as much as he was out of it, he always says, the Rolling Stones was always my band.
Yes.
It was never Mick's band.
No.
He was always the guy that made everybody work.
Yes.
Because Mick was off doing whatever he was doing.
That's right.
You know, but it was Keith Richards who kind of held it all together.
Mick is off being a dandy, and that's right.
A dandy and a bit of a playboy.
Yeah, that's right.
Effectively, you know.
Marrying, like, Bianca Jagger and all that kind of stuff in Monaco and all that. But but the thing I was going to tell you about Brian Jones was that he came from a very middle class Cheltenham family.
Yeah.
His father was a churchman.
Right.
I think he was something like...
They were all fairly middle class, weren't
they? Oh, they're all fairly middle class, yeah. Well, John Lennon was middle class.
Mm.
You know, and the working class hero and all that doesn't sit really very aptly with John Lennon's upbringing. Although he wasn't brought up by his mother, he was brought up by his auntie right. Mimi. And she was very middle class, you know. They were you know, the rock salt of the middle classes.
Yeah.
But anyway, Brian Jones rebelled against his parents', you know, straightforward way of life.
Yeah.
And so they used to say, oh, do keep in touch, Brian, won't you? And he would ring them once a week to give his shocked mother and father an update on how many women...
On his debauched life.
Yeah, how many women he'd had sex with that week. Yeah. How much he'd drunk, how many drugs he'd taken.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, I gave two girls VD this week, Mum. Yeah. Just a shocker, he hadn't actually.
And I've made another 5,000 quid or something.
Yeah, that's right, but just to shock them, you know. But anyway, what I'm saying is, now, where this all...
Have you seen Mad Men, by the way?
Yes, I've seen Mad Men. The advertising.
The American
thing.
Show about that.
I never quite got it, actually.
Well, the whole point of that is partly the kind of advent of women, because at the beginning of the show, you see all the women are employed as secretaries.
Right.
And as the show goes on, the women become account managers, they become bosses, they suddenly have a much bigger role in the firm.
It's a very shapely lady in that.
I thought you might be able to say that. That's probably why you watched it, right? I can't remember her name.
Yeah, I can't remember.
It's a sort of redheaded
Christina?
One. Christina?
Christina Hendricks or something like that.
Yes, you might be right.
Yeah, but anyway, one thing that did emerge, as you just said, job opportunities in the 60s.
Yeah.
Was the creation of the Playboy Club.
Yeah.
Now, that opened on Park Lane in 1966. Did you ever go there?
I did.
Yeah, I did a few
times.
I
went there.
As well.
I'll tell you when I went there. I might have gone there once or twice, but I went there one night, funnily enough, with my sister.
Right.
When she was working for that Indian firm. When she first started working in the city, her boss was a guy called Setia,
right.
Who ended up going to jail
for
all sorts of fraud.
Yeah, right.
Because he was a right fucking. Yeah. Shyster.
Right, these things happen,
But they were basically commodity traders.
Yes.
And so there was a lot of Indian guys around at one point. And I remember we were out one night and she said to me, why don't you stick around because I don't look at this guy.
Yeah.
And this guy, Freddie, I think his name was, wanted to take her to the Playboy Club.
Right.
So she said, well, you can take me as long as my brother can come.
Yeah.
So I went along as
The chaperone.
I was like the chaperone, he was staying at the Hilton or something, Park Lane. He was trying to Rogerize her and get her up to the room.
Dear me.
And I was there as the kind of protector.
Yes, sure.
But unfortunately, I took rather a strong interest in the drink that I was getting for free.
Yes.
Because every time I wanted something, I'd just go up to him and say, can you give me another 25 quid?
Yeah.
And he was just giving me money.
Really?
Because I would go and gamble.
That's a very sort of... I'm going to describe you as a ponce for doing that, in the sense of poncing money off
that.
People.
Well, yeah,
I think you can.
Well, because I didn't have any money at that time.
Yeah.
You know, and I was in the
Playboy
Club. You
were working in the bakery or something at the time.
I think I might have been working in the Asian Post magazine
first
job. So I was making less money than I was making in the fucking bakery.
Right,
I was making about $4,000 a year.
Yeah, right, you know?
So I had no money.
No.
I certainly didn't have money to play in the Playboy Club.
No, sure.
I couldn't even buy a drink there.
No, sure.
So he kept buying me drinks, sort of fobbing me off.
Yeah.
And every time he fobbed me off, he'd give me another 20 quid.
Yeah.
I took about 200 quid off him that night and lost it all on the gambling tables because I was so pissed that, you know, because I was also drinking every time I went back.
And was this
drink.
In the Playboy Club?
This is in the Playboy Club.
Right, okay, yeah.
And at one point I was told off because I tried to chat up one of the Playboy bunnies.
Yeah, you're not supposed to do
and
that.
And you're not meant to talk to them.
No.
You know, they sort of stand around.
Yeah, that's right.
And you're not allowed to touch them.
No.
And I was more
unless your name's Victor Lowndes.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Because he was the boss of the Playboy
Club that's different.
In this country. And he went out with a lady called, was it Marilyn Cole?
Yes.
Beautiful.
She was a former Miss World, wasn't she?
Yeah, well, she was a former Miss Playboy Centerfold or something that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't think she was Miss World.
Right.
I mean, you know.
But yeah, that's the only time I remember being there.
Yeah.
So
I used to go there when I first came to London because my sister was working at Revlon. And of course, that was part of the sort of marketing scene in those days. Uh-huh. Meetings happened in the Playboy Club, and yeah, and I went to a couple of them, you know. And
what, with your sister?
Well, my sister and her boyfriend used to, both worked at Revlon.
Okay.
And they used to go there, and they'd have a table, you know, and they'd invite me, and I'd, you know, go, and other people would come along.
Sleazy.
Yeah, well, it was all done on expenses and things. But anyway, look.
Was you in the papers at that time?
Yeah, I was working for the Birmingham Mail in London, you see, so I had no money either. I was quite broke. I didn't pay for a lot of stuff. It all went on the expense accounts of these advertising guys. But anyway, it says, while the fashion was for androgynous waif-like models such as Twiggy in the newspapers, the Playboy Bunny was a male fantasy of femininity.
Yeah.
Bunnies had to squeeze into corseted costumes and gave them the greatest possible bonbon.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
And they had to wear 5-inch heels, white fluffy tails and bunny ears whilst serving cocktails.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine that now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, absolutely. One Playboy bunny called Just Patsy talks about her days as a bunny. She said, the costume, it was such great fun. Who would not like wearing a bunny costume? I know feminists would be appalled, but we didn't feel that way.
Yeah.
We didn't see it that we were prostituting ourselves or that it was sleazy. It was a job.
Right.
It was a well-paid job, and I can tell you, it was fun, and we loved being the centre of attraction. The Playboy Club came to Britain at about the same time as the word sexism. On the one hand, romantic novelist Barbara Cartland was still advising that unless a woman is ill, she should get up and cook her husband's breakfast every day before he goes to work.
And was this at the time of... Was Hugh Hefner involved at this point or not?
Well, Hugh Hefner was the boss of Playboy in Chicago, wasn't he?
In the US
American
of A,
operation.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And Victor Lowndes was his man in Britain.
So Hugh Hefner didn't own the Playboy Club then?
Yes, he did, yeah.
Oh, he did, yeah.
Oh, he did, yeah. Right. But Victor Lowndes was, you know, Mr. Playboy UK, you know what I mean? It was the second biggest market after the United States, because a lot of countries like, believe it or not, Germany, places like that wouldn't license Playboy clubs because they said they were too sleazy.
Yeah. But we licensed them. It's pretty good coming from Germany.
Yeah, it certainly is. Mm.
So,
right, now
apart
then,
from a feminist doctrine, what else have you been reading?
Well, we've got to get a bit political now, okay?
Really?
Because I've been sent a book about Donald Trump.
Oh, yeah.
So we both know quite a bit about Donald Trump.
Is this the one written by Vicky Ward?
It's written by...
it's about...
Hang on,
Trump experience.
It's written by Victor Davis Hanson.
Oh, okay.
And it's called The Case for Trump.
Oh, right, that's different. I think Vicky Ward has written one...
Oh,
his daughter, maybe.
Oh, I see.
And
okay,
Jared Kushner.
Well, what this book says is, it says it's called The Case for Trump, and it lays out the reasons why this guy believes that Trump will romp home again in 2020.
I don't think there's any doubt about that.
You think
really
so?
I think he will.
Yeah.
Well, there isn't anybody up against him. I mean, who's going to challenge Donald Trump?
Yeah.
And as much as we keep hearing from, like you were saying the other week, that, you know, socialism is kind of gripping America.
That's right.
Because people hate Trump so much.
Yes.
They're still very much in the, in the minority.
Yes.
And when I was in America recently, not one person had anything to say about Trump.
No.
You know, so it's not like here where everybody's completely obsessed with Brexit.
Yes.
And when you walk past people on the street, you can hear people having conversations about
it.
The whole time I was in California, and I was in lots of different places, walking around the streets, in lots of restaurants, nobody mentioned Trump.
Right.
You know, so you didn't get the sense that, you know, everybody hates Trump.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, he says it'll happen for a number of reasons. One is a booming economy.
Yeah.
Historically low unemployment. So people are saying he can do it, and they overlook the things they don't like about him, right? Mm. It says that... they all made the mistake the first time that Trump ran for presidency of thinking that it was all a joke and that he didn't seem to have any clear policies. But it's now clear that American voters, like voters around the world, don't care about policies.
No.
They care more about the person.
And they care about the image. And do you remember that image of him going to, was it Ohio? I think it was Ohio, where Hillary Clinton refused to go because she was so sure she was going to win the seat because it was a heartland Democrat seat.
Sure.
But Ohio's always been one of those swing states, you know.
Yeah.
And he went there and talked to the guys who were in the factories, said that he was going to rebuild
the
America,
said
he was going to put money into it. She didn't bother going.
Right.
He won that state.
He won the state.
And that helped him win the whole thing.
Exactly,
She was terribly complacent.
Oh, terribly, now, it says that what he did was he didn't concentrate on policy matters. It can be summed up, the campaign he ran, as forcing of the Democrats to concentrate on race,
yeah,
which is a huge issue in America, while he stuck to class lines.
Yeah.
Okay?
Right.
So it says, whether or not this president is a racist, he's made his presidency a scream on behalf of the working class,
yeah,
or those with working class attitudes. The Democrats and their supporters risk being seen, quite bluntly, as anti-white.
Yeah.
Because they spend so much time worrying about racism. Mm-hmm. And racism is a one-way vehicle.
Yeah.
It's white people being racist to black people, yeah, not black people being racist,
yeah,
to white.
That's right.
And Donald Trump doesn't accept that. He thinks racism, uh-huh, exists in all areas of life, right? Right.
So, well, I mean, in the last few weeks, he's been, yeah, accused of being a white supremacist.
That's right, yeah.
Because he didn't come out and condemn enough.
Yes.
The guy from New Zealand.
That's right.
But in fact, he did condemn him.
Yeah.
But according to the Democrats, he didn't condemn him
hard enough. No, that's right, yeah. So it says, for decades, race and gender studies, academics have argued that overtly expressed racism against whites is not racism.
Right.
So the liberal left academic,
okay,
say, well, it's not racist.
Well, this is like the Labour Party's definition of anti-Semitism, right?
Of course it is,
until,
yeah,
they can define it, it's not anti-Semitism.
Yeah, yeah. He says that's not racism. For decades, race and gender studies academics had argued that overtly expressed racism against white is not racism, but had to be contextualised by prior white oppression.
Prior white oppression?
Well, they're going back to slavery, yeah, aren't they? You know, 200 years ago, yeah, you know, right? In the age of furor and crude slurs against Trump, their theories now went off campus and were being educated by a wider constituency, and they did not win any agreement from the wider general public.
There's an awful lot of weird shit going on university campuses these days that, yeah, you and I have no idea,
exactly,
about.
Right? Yeah.
The idea that, yeah, for example, there are all these different groups fighting each other,
yes,
preventing people from going to speak,
yes,
at their you know, esteemed seat of learning.
That's right.
Just because they don't agree with them. I mean, it's shocking, really.
Yeah, it is absolutely shocking. But anyway, look, that's all very heavy stuff and all about racism. Basically, it says that Donald Trump set out to do some of the things he said he would do in his, yeah, election campaign, and he's getting on with them, even if people don't,
well,
like them.
I mean, one of the things,
yeah,
that's quite remarkable about him,
yes,
I would say, and you don't want to turn it into a sort of, you know,
yeah,
homage to Trump,
yeah,
is that he's getting criticised for doing what he said he would do.
Yes, that's right.
I mean,
yeah,
no politician in history,
yes,
has ever done what he said. I mean, this nonsense that we get now about Brexit, saying,
yeah,
oh, well, of course, nobody knew what they were voting for.
That's right, yeah.
It's rubbish. Everybody, yeah, knew what they were voting,
that's,
for.
That's right, yeah.
So, you know, they don't need to be patronised by, yeah, a bunch of middle-class tosspots.
That's right.
You know?
He says that what happened was, in the Trump campaign, again, the liberal elite left saw Trump's campaign as a project of fun, you,
yeah,
know, as a figure of fun. And for the guardians of the mainstream culture, they just tried to tear it to bits every day. Mm. They constantly wrote that this was a futile and damaging presidential run, mm, keeping a proper candidate out, you know, of the mainstream of politics.
Yeah.
Okay,
right.
But
that's the problem.
Yeah,
the Republicans don't have anybody,
yeah,
to put up against Trump, so that he could win the nomination and become the,
that's
next,
right,
president.
That's right.
And the Democrats haven't got anyone either.
No, that's right. It says all these liberal left were just waiting for Trump to implode. He never did.
No.
Before Trump imploded, the networks thought he would likely incinerate the Republican Party along with him and destroy the Republican Party.
Yeah.
So they didn't give him such a hard time while, mm, he was on it. They thought that because he was so bad, he would smash the Republican,
right,
Party forever.
Well, they've got it all wrong, haven't they?
Yeah.
This is the whole point of what is going,
yeah,
wrong,
absolutely,
currently. If you look at what's happening in France,
yes,
where the old Yellow Jackets every single weekend now,
yeah,
are fighting with the police.
Well, do you know where they come from? They come from these little coterie,
yeah,
towns around Paris.
Yeah.
And there's nothing for them in France.
No.
They're the guys who
traipse. They're all the people in every country who have been left behind.
They're the people who traipse in from these little towns surrounding Paris every day, commuters, to drive the buses,
yeah,
to provide public services,
uh-huh,
to work in lowly paid shops, to, you know, basically.
There might be farm workers as well outside. Some,
no,
you know,
they stay out. They stay out, but they have low standards of living anyway, mm, and there's nothing for them. And France is a very elitist country. It's a bit like Victorian Britain.
Yeah.
You've either got a lot of money and you live in style and you go to restaurants on the Champs-Élysées, or you've got nothing.
Yeah.
And also, there's a huge swathe of, you know, second and third generation immigrants in France,
yeah,
who basically feel the country's never done anything for them.
No.
In a way that in
quite,
this country,
I mean, people,
we have.
And in a massive,
yeah,
way, it's quite a,
yeah,
very racist country, France, as,
yeah,
well.
It's very,
much more,
yeah,
so than,
I agree,
here.
I agree.
More so than here.
I agree. Now, another book I want to tell you,
yeah,
about, it's called Arabs.
Arabs.
It's called Arabs.
This is a very intellectual, porky review of books.
Well, I think it should be.
So far, you've tackled feminism.
Yeah.
You've tackled the American presidential situation.
Yeah.
You're now going to talk to me about Arabs.
Yeah, but when I talked to you about Rogerizing earlier on, you said this seems to be a common theme with you.
Well, I mean, I didn't expect it to just be about sex, you know.
Yeah, well, it's not just about sex, is it? I'm going to tell you about Henry VI in a minute as well. World's most useless king. Most useless king.
It's funny, you know, you never really think. Yeah. You think of Henry VII.
Yeah.
You think of Henry V.
Yeah.
You think of Henry VIII.
Yes.
You never think of Henry VI.
No,
you?
No.
Is that why he was useless?
He was useless.
Because he didn't do anything.
He had some sort of medical condition, which nobody ever found out what it was, but it rendered him immobile and useless for long periods of time. I mean,
I know a couple of people who've got that.
Yeah, being rendered immobile and useless. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, what he would do is he was also a bit mad.
Yeah.
He had a genetic component of madness.
So he came after Henry V, who, of course, famously battled the French.
Is Agincourt.
In Agincourt.
That's right, yeah.
Henry VII was the kind of precursor to
Henry VIII
and the Tudors, right?
That's right, yeah.
I don't think I've ever heard anything about Henry VI.
Well, this is why I found this book about him. Mm. It's called Shadow King.
Oh, yeah.
Henry VI was an incompetent king, but a total innocent. He never did anything, you know?
He must have been quite short-reigned, wasn't he?
Eh?
Was it quite a short reign?
Quite a short reign it was. Henry discovered after his mother's death, and she was Catherine of Valois.
Okay.
There
was a lot of Catherines around in
those days. There were in those days, yeah. She'd secretly been having it away with a handsome Welsh commoner known as Owen Tudor.
All right.
Hello, Owen Tudor. Tasty.
Tidy.
Yeah, and he's not quite sure who his father was.
Really?
Yeah. The virtue that was most valued in a woman in those days was chastity.
Uh-huh.
And when he discovered his mother had not been chaste, he faced a lifelong shame. Mm. Okay?
Right.
And
well, so Henry V was clearly not his dad then?
Well, we don't know. Could have been. I mean, the thing is, if a woman's having it away with more than one man, in those days they didn't have DNA tests.
No.
So they wouldn't have been able to tell who'd actually
fathered
the child.
It's not a very pleasant way of putting it, that.
What?
Having it away.
Well, she was having it away, wasn't she, you know?
If she had multiple sex partners, you
it looks
say.
Like it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it says Henry VI was weak and he had poor judgment.
Right.
Sure,
we don't know somebody like that as well.
Yeah, exactly. It became necessary for dynastic reasons for Henry that Edmund Tudor was married into the House of Lancaster. That's how it became
See,
the Tudors.
Edmund Tudor, I've heard of.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've never heard of Henry VI. It's never occurred to me that there wasn't one.
Yeah, well, it was all madness in those days because before Edmund Tudor could enter the House of Lancaster, they had to get married. Problem was, he married a 9-year-old bride called Margaret Beaufort.
Right.
That
can't be right, can it?
Yeah, well, what do you mean?
Marrying children.
Well, of course it's not right. It's disgraceful, disgusting, isn't it? Right. That's what they used to do in those days.
I mean, if you were to go back through your historical sort of knowledge, there would be about, say, 5 or 6 kings that you would name.
Yes.
He would definitely not be one of them.
No, definitely wouldn't be none of them, no. So what happened was he fucking lost everything, this guy, Henry VI, while he was in one of his, immobile periods, you know, 2 or 3 days. Unfortunately, the Hundred Years' War was going on.
Oh, dear.
Now, you know, the problem was...
How's that going,
days.
King? Yeah, we're still going with the war.
The Hundred Years' War going on. And that, of course, is with France, right?
Right.
Now, the problem was, you're quite right, his grandfather had led the most famous battle in the history of warfare up till then, Agincourt, and won it. Of course, that was Henry V. I was thinking of My Horse.
No, that was the Battle of the Roses, wasn't it? War of the Roses.
That's right, that was Richard.
That was Richard III.
That's Richard. A horse, my kingdom for a horse.
Yes.
No, squire, fuck off, you're not getting a horse. I mean, that was a bit harsh, wasn't
it? I'll tell you what, there was a great movie. I think it was starring Laurence Olivier.
Yes, it was,
III,
I see him in my mind, yes.
And then the other great movie about Agincourt, I don't know if you've seen this one, was the Kenneth Branagh one.
Kenneth Branagh
was starred as Henry V.
Did he?
It was really good.
Is it good?
Very good.
Yeah.
I would say the best thing he's ever done.
I think he takes himself a bit seriously.
I think
Kenneth
he does
Branagh,
too. I agree. Yeah. However, this is brilliant.
He was brilliant in that Scandinavian thing, you know?
Wallander. That was good.
Wallander. But he used to keep leaving his gun all over the place.
Well,
because his mind went, didn't he?
His mind went.
He got dementia.
You know what I didn't like about that show? Was he kept driving around that shitty Volvo.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I hated the
Volvo.
Volvo
estate, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I hated the car.
The estate, yeah.
I was like,
yeah.
Get a better car.
Yeah, he used to wander around in field shouting at himself because he'd gone a bit like loopy, you know. But
I actually not only watched that, but I also watched the original Wallander.
Yes.
Which was actually done in Swedish.
Oh, yeah?
Right, with some other guy.
Right, okay, yeah. Mm. But anyway, so everybody kept saying, Sire, you know, you should be on a horse at the front of the battle because we've got a bit of a problem.
Sire.
Yeah, and they said, what's the problem? And they said, this is in July of 1453, okay?
It's going to be one of the more obscure porky reviews of books we've ever done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Fucking Henry VI.
So they said, he said, "What's the problem? Can't you cope without me?" And they said, "Not really." He said, "We've failed in so many of the battles now in the Hundred Years' War, which you should have been in charge of, that it's over."
So what, he lost the Hundred Years' War.
He said it's over. And he said,
actually, he couldn't have been in charge for very long.
Well, it was the last couple of years of the Hundred Years' War, apparently.
Right.
So, it's ended. He said, oh, right, so are we all friends again now?
Right.
He said, no, are we bollocks, said his advisors. He said, the French have captured Castillon on the Dordogne River, which was the main town we've all been fighting about for the last 100 years.
Oh, yeah.
He says, well, what does that leave me with? They said, fuck all squared. Seriously.
A bit foul-mouthed, these aides.
Yeah, they were, yeah. They said, our French Empire is now reduced to the Pale of Calais, which is just literally the harbour of Calais, you know?
Yeah.
Upon this news, Henry VI, who'd been immobile, suddenly went into a frenzy and started rolling around and foaming at the mouth. And he couldn't, because of the shocks, the people think he had a fit.
Right.
He couldn't move or speak for another 4 days.
Right.
And it said, from then on, his wit and reason appear to have been withdrawn forever.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, yeah. So
what year was that then? Do you know? Does it say?
Yeah, 1453. The end of the Hundred Years' War.
Okay.
So he didn't do a great job, old Henry VI, but he was apparently a very nice man. After his death, the popularity of his cult became greater in England than even that of St. Thomas a Becket at Canterbury, who had the third most visited pilgrimage site in Europe. But the Vatican, never tactful in its relations with England... now, if he was Henry VI, so it was two more Henrys before we denounced the Catholic Church.
But it might not have been straight from 6 to 7 to 8, might it?
No, that's true.
We'll have to check the succession.
Yeah, decided to make Henry an official saint, and his cult was forgotten after the Reformation. He remained in the shadows of history and has done ever since. Henry's character, scrupulously and sensibly drawn as a man to all things good, that shaped the extraordinary and dramatic events of his reign. But they weren't extraordinary matters. We lost the Hundred Years' War. About it.
Well, you'd think he'd be famous for that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you'd think so, yeah.
I'm looking through the old succession to see who came after him.
But anyway, look, you know, because you asked me to up the ante and get away from the Rogerisation...
So you've got very... you managed to get some Rogerisation in.
Yeah, did I tell you about the Arabs book, didn't I?
You didn't mention...
I mean, basically...
Well, you mentioned it, but you didn't tell me what it's about.
Yeah, it's called Arabs, A 3,000-Year History of Peoples. And what it says is what I've been trying to tell successive politicians for the last 25 blinking years.
Oh, yeah.
And that is that when you invade an Arab country, you are not invading a country which is run by a stable leader and the head of a democracy. You're invading a country where the leader has been the strongest of a group of tribes within that country and keep the other tribes down to maintain their power and their position as a leader.
Uh-huh.
Once you get rid of that leader, somebody else will come along and try to lead by killing a lot of the other people in the country who also want to lead the country.
Because they bear a grudge against each other.
I mean, people like David Cameron and the little French guy, you know, Sarkozy.
Oh, yeah.
And even George W. Bush are so thick that they couldn't realise that when you smash up an Arab country, you then have a war on your hands, not a grateful populace who comes to say, oh, thank you for getting rid of our evil leader. All leaders are evil in Arabia because they have to flex their muscles and exercise their power militarily, physically and emotionally and brutally and keep people in jails because that's the way Middle East runs.
Well, the other problem, which is what ISIS created, really, was that they said, well, all of these borders that have been drawn up between Iraq and Syria and Iran, these were all drawn up by a couple of blokes from Britain and France at the beginning of the fucking last century.
No, you're absolutely right. What do we do with the Palestine problem? Yeah. Palestine problem, what's that? Well, it's all these Arab peoples wandering around the Sahara Desert and associated countries, North Africa, you know, into the Middle East, you know, what is now Israel.
Yeah.
We've got to get it sorted.
Hey,
okay.
Listen, I found out some information about Henry VI.
Right, go on.
He was gentle and retiring, it says here. He came to the throne as a baby and inherited a losing war with France.
Yeah. And well, he lost it.
Well, he first came in 1422, 1461. Yeah. Yeah. He was then followed by Edward IV.
Edward IV.
Right?
Yeah.
Who was then followed by Edward V.
Yeah.
Who was then followed by Richard III.
Yes.
You know.
The guy, my horse.
And so Henry
the kingdom
VII.
Kingdom for my horse.
Henry VII didn't come in for, you know, another sort of four kings in between.
Well, I know that because, of course, this was 1485. Henry VIII, who founded my school, founded it in 1548.
Oh, yeah.
So that's another 100 years on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Henry VII came in 1485.
Well, there you go.
After the Battle of Bosworth.
There you go.
Which was when Richard III got...
That's right.
Have you ever been to the Tower of London, by the way?
Yes, I have, yes.
Have you ever been to the Tower?
Is that where the
twins... The Bloody Tower.
Where the twins were murdered?
Yeah.
Yes, I've seen all that. Yeah, I've seen all that, yeah.
It's cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it is very good, yeah.
Yeah.
I took a young lady there, actually, to educate her.
Why?
Just thought she needed a bit of cultural...
Did you think that would be some kind of prelim to Rogerisation?
I did indeed, and I was
right. You thought you'd impress her that you were sort of intellectually bound.
Exactly,
and into history.
Yeah, tell her the history of the Tower of London.
There must have been some drink involved, surely.
Oh, there's loads of drink involved. We went for lunch then in a place in the city.
Did you go to Pont-de-la-Tour?
No, we went to the other place down there. It's called... It was next to Pont-de-la-Tour, but it's more of a cafe-type place, you know?
Oh, the Chop House?
Chop House it could have been,
The place.
Could have been the Chop House, yeah. And then
still there, those two places.
And then visited the hotel next door, the...
What, the Howard?
No.
What used to be the Howard?
No. The one, you know, which is there, right next to the Tower of London.
I know the one, sorry.
Is it the Tower Hotel?
It used to be called the Tower Hotel.
It's now
got a Japanese name because it's now owned by some Japanese company.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the one that our friend from the Sun threw himself out of, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. That's right, yeah.
Nick, what's his name?
Nick Parker.
Nick Parker.
Yes, it was a refreshing afternoon, I have to say.
Very nice. What was the name?
I can't tell you that. I'm sorry. I'm a gentleman. I don't talk about these things.
With the two mics.
Women were finding their voice, but they still got a bad deal. Woman is singled out from the beginning. She's something special. Passive, frivolous, weak, lacking in leadership, incapable of dealing with power. Women are seen to be a slave group, appendages of men without identities of their own, and I'm talking about without them having their own freedom.
When did you start reading this feminist claptrap?
He says, no, sorry?
When did you start reading this feminist
claptrap? Well, because I am a feminist.
What?
I support women's rights. No,
I've heard it all now.
I
never trust a man with a beard who claims to be a feminist.
No.
You can't be a feminist.
Nowhere was the woman more appendage-like than in the phallocentric, that's what it's called,
phallocentric
world of rock and roll.
What does that mean?
Well, we've just discussed that groupies were available at all times, 24 hours a day.
For phallus.
Yes, that's right, phallocentric.
That's a ridiculous
phallo. No, it's phallocentric is a good phrase, right? He said the French have captured Castillon on the Dordogne River, which was the main town we've all been fighting about for the last 100 years.
Oh, yeah.
He says, well, what does that leave me with? They said, fuck all squared. Seriously.
A bit foul-mouthed, these aides.
Yeah, they were, yeah. They said, our French Empire is now reduced to the Pale of Calais, which is just literally the harbour of Calais, you know?
Yeah.
Upon this news, Henry VI, who'd been immobile, suddenly went into a frenzy and started rolling around and foaming at the mouth. he had some sort of medical condition, which nobody ever found out what it was. but it rendered him immobile and useless for long periods of time. I mean,
I know a couple of people who've got that.
Yeah.